This week's message is brought to us by one of our elders, Ed Whittington. The title is Being Thankful, and the reading is Luke 17, 11-21. Now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. They stood at a distance and called out in a loud voice, "Jesus, Master, have pity on us!" When he saw them, he said, "Go, show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. Jesus asked, "Were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner?" Then he said to him, "Rise and go. Your faith has made you well." Once on being asked by the Pharisees when the kingdom of God would come, Jesus replied, "The coming of the kingdom of God is not something that can be observed, nor will people say, 'Here it is,' or 'There it is,' because the kingdom of God is in your midst."
I too would like to echo a welcome to all who have gathered here today. Many of you knew that I was speaking and came anyways, and I'm grateful for that. The book of Genesis is a record, what I would say, of several dysfunctional families. So let's look briefly at Jacob, son of Isaac. Jacob worked for 7 years for Laban to be able to have Rachel for a wife. If you read the scriptures about what happened, they had this big celebration, and I guess Laban brings his wife to Jacob after dark, because he wakes up in the morning and it's not Rachel that he's been with, it's Leah. So Laban deceived Jacob. Jacob presses and makes a deal that, you know, if I work 7 more years, then I can have Rachel for my wife. Well, right here we have some dysfunctionality, I would say. So the children start coming. Leah has 6 children, 7 children, and 6 boys and 1 girl. But see, Rachel, she is the one who's really loved, but she's barren. But at some point in time, she conceives and has 2 children, Joseph and Benjamin. But both of these women also have maidens, servants, who are females, and Jacob has 4 children with 2 of these servants. So the count is this: 12 sons and 1 daughter, 4 mothers. I would say that's a recipe for a disaster, and it indicates some dysfunctionality. It's interesting that these 12 brothers, they become the leaders of the tribes of Israel, one of which leads the tribe that Jesus comes from. Today, I would like us to focus on the character of interest is Joseph. He became sort of the favorite son of Jacob. And however, he has an assortment of brothers that don't like him, actually hate him. So Joseph is 17, and his father says to him, you know, go down to Shechem and check up on your brothers. So he goes down there to check up on them, and they see him coming, and they plot to kill him. Now, you'd say that's kind of odd behavior for brothers. But these brothers, as I talked about in my Bible class this morning, they had already been up to no good. When their father Jacob settled near Shechem, their sister Diane went into town, and she was raped. And when the brothers come back, they pay for it. They go into the city, and if you read it, it's kind of gruesome. They make a deal that they will spare them if all of the men in Shechem are circumcised. And then 3 days after they're circumcised, they went in and slaughtered them all. So these are the boys that Israel is going, all of the tribes of Israel are going to come from. So when their brother shows up and they don't like him, I can understand why they might take it into their own hands to do something about it. Well, they decide not to kill him, but they throw him in a pit and they sell him to some Ishmaelites, and he goes off to Egypt. Now, in the scriptures it says, and they went to Egypt, and then the next verse says, they're in Egypt. Well, it's about 750 miles, and Joseph is probably lashed in a row with other servants, other prisoners that are going off, and they have to march from here to Quebec City. So in that little verse, in between those two verses, there's a lot happening, and I can imagine what, you know, Joseph is thinking. Oh, this is so much fun. I get to go to Egypt. This is cool, being dragged here and chained and whipped, and it's fun times. Well, when he gets to Egypt, he ends up being in Potiphar's house, who is an official, government official, and he does really well. So he's elevated to sort of run the household. Well, in Genesis chapter 29 and verse 17, Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. So Rachel is Joseph's mother. Well, in Genesis chapter 29 and verse 6, it says, it's not going to be shown. Anyhow, I'll tell you what it says. Joseph is described as beautiful in form and appearance. Thank you, Mom. Okay? Well, Potiphar's wife desires to have Joseph, this young Hebrew, as a lover. Joseph resists. Now, just so you know, you just say, well, Joseph resists. So he's in this other country, different customs, different language. He's away from home. He's been abandoned. And this woman wants to have him as a lover, and he's a strapping young Hebrew, and he resists. Now, the men out there are thinking, that'd be tough. Some of you are old enough to say, well, forget it. But he resists. And he gets stuck with her alone, and there's nobody in the house, and she comes on him again, and he runs, and she grabs his coat, and he runs out. Well, then she lies to her husband about what happened. He ends up in prison. And he's in prison for some time, and during this time in prison, he becomes a favorite of the warden, and the warden puts him in charge of the whole prison. And as part of his work, he's going around, he's checking on things, and he comes across these two, a cupbearer and a baker that are put in there by Pharaoh, and they have these dreams, he interprets the dreams, and it comes true. And he says to the cupbearer, who ends up going back into Pharaoh's house, remember me to Pharaoh. So you would think, you know, this good thing happened. I had this dream, it came true, and I'm going to go and tell Pharaoh right away. He doesn't say anything until Pharaoh, 2 years later, has some dreams, and then he goes, oh yeah, there was this guy Joseph in prison. He interpreted my dreams, and it came true. So Pharaoh pulls Joseph out of prison. He tells him the dreams, and Joseph interprets the dreams. And now this is the thing. He has the audacity to tell him what the dreams mean, and then he has the audacity to tell him what to do. This little shepherd boy from Canaan, been in prison, had all these terrible experiences, and he tells Pharaoh, you need to get somebody to look after this. So Pharaoh appoints Joseph to administer this thing. 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. Well, Joseph's had quite a journey from his time as shepherd boy to second in command in Egypt. What kind of times has he had? Very difficult, emotional, physical, spiritual journey. But there's one thing about Joseph. He never, ever gives up on God. He honors God in everything that he does. But he doesn't say very much. His actions speak louder than the few words that he says. Well, I came across a story recently. In 1860, September 8th, 1860, at 2 a.m. in the morning, a ship was going in Lake Michigan. It was a schooner, and there were people aboard having a good time, and the ship was wrecked. And a young seminary student named Edward Spence had taken life-saving. He rushes to the shore of Lake Michigan, and over the next several hours, he retrieves 15 people out of the lake. In the morning, he is exhausted by the fire, and someone yells, "There's two more out there hanging onto some wood," and back into the water he goes. Now, Edward Spence, as a result of these actions, spent the rest of his life being partially disabled. He spent most of his life in a wheelchair. What he did? He was asked by a Los Angeles reporter that was writing an article about this, and you can Google this name and you can read the articles. And he said he interviewed him and he says, "Do you remember anything unique about that night?" "Only this. Of the 17 people I saved, not one came to say thank you." Now you wonder why that would be. Surely they must have recognized the difficulty that he had in retrieving them out of the lake. They were 17 out of 300 people who survived this. Well, maybe they lost other people or other family members that died during that, and so they were dealing with that grief. Maybe they were so dealing with physical, emotional trauma that prevented them from reflecting on how they were saved. Well, many of us, I think, are more acquainted with the language of grumbling and complaining rather than appreciation and thankfulness that tend to inhabit sort of the back of our minds. Joseph teaches us many things, and one of the things that he teaches us is the power of gratitude. All the things that Joseph experienced, we did not hear one word of complaint. So in Genesis chapter 41, in verse of 51 to 53, he ends up in a good place. He's dealing with this famine, and he's meeting, you know, he's handing out grain and whatnot. He's married and he has children. Well, his first child, in this verse it indicates, his first child is Manasseh. It's a Hebrew name. And it means is that God helped me or made me forget all that had happened at the hands of my brothers. So Joseph wants to thank God every time he says his son's name or he hears his son's name. You know what? I'm thankful to God because he helped me to forget these things that have happened in my past. And then he has a second son. And the second son's name means God made me fruitful in a land of affliction. So again, every time he hears the son's name or says his son's name, he's reminded that God made me fruitful in the land of affliction. So unlike the survivors of the shipwreck in Lake Michigan, Joseph remembers to be thankful. Well, really, does it matter to God that we stop and give thanks? Well, the story that was read today about Jesus encountering the lepers, and he said he stood at a distance, which was a common practice. And they say, "Have mercy on us." And he says to them, "Well, go show yourself to the priest. Because when you have leprosy, the priest makes a decision whether you're clean or unclean. So if the priest says you're clean, you're clean. If you're unclean, then you have to go around, you know, and say, unclean, unclean, you know, cover your face and expect people to throw rocks at you, beat and send you out of town." So they go off to see the priest. And it's curious that it says, on the way, they were healed. So what's that look like? So they're walking along, and now they can feel the sores disappearing. And now their joints aren't as painful, and they're starting to stand up tall. Their complexion changes as they're walking to the priest. So they're experiencing an absolutely miraculous healing. And one person out of the 10 turns and goes back to Jesus. And Jesus is waiting. And he falls down and he gives thanks and he worships Jesus. And Jesus says, seems to be disappointed that only one returned. He says, "So, where are they? Where are the rest of them?" "Oh, well, maybe they are so excited about the changes that have taken place that they've just sort of forgot how it all happened." Perhaps they're being cautious. You know, this is too good to be true. Probably isn't true. So it's probably going to, you know, it's going to change back. Some maybe are self-centered, too self-centered to be thankful. Some might be arrogant, too arrogant to be thankful. They don't admit that they need help. So many of these explanations can hit home for us because we can be like that as well. Something really excellent happens and we're being blessed and we're just like, "Yeah, well, I deserve it." You know, and you're not really thankful for it, but you take sort of a pompous, proud attitude. And so there's these contrasts between, you know, grumbling and being grateful, complaining and being thankful. I read a quote. It says, "A proud man is seldom grateful, for he never thinks he gets what he deserves." On the other hand, humility, on the other hand, creates grateful people. There are so many things in our lives that we can be thankful for. And one is that Paul says in Romans chapter 8 and verse 32 that God gives us everything, graciously gives us everything that we need. Well, everything, you know, is that a new cell phone, you know, a new car? So we sometimes think about those things, but there's a lot more things that we could be grateful for. And some of these things that we're grateful for are free, but we don't really notice them as much. Rhonda and I and our family have spent 34 years every summer going to Sabo Beach. And it's amazing, in the evening, since Sabo Beach is a western exposure, there's a sunset. And every night, people gravitate to the beach. And they go there and they stand. Most of them stand or sit. And they look at the sun going down. Well, the sun's not really going down. The earth's rotating away from the sun. But they stand there. and stare at it. And oftentimes there is no words. They just admire this beauty. They listen to the rhythm of the waves. They feel the breeze coming, the warm breeze. And if they happen to be holding somebody they love, it's a bonus. It's just marvelous. And it's free. If you see it, if you sense it, if you feel it, it's free. It's something to be grateful for. I don't know about you, but you probably don't realize this, that most of us each day are going to inhale and exhale 11,000 liters of air into our lungs. If you don't breathe in 11,000 liters today, you're going to have a different day. But these gases go into your lungs, and each lung has about a million little microscopic sacs. And the air goes in there, and the oxygen, which is in a higher concentration than the blood that's going right past these little sacs, diffuses into your blood. And the carbon dioxide that's in the blood diffuses into the lung space because its concentration is higher than in the lung space. It's called diffusion. And then you breathe out this air that has 16% oxygen in comparison to 20% oxygen going in, and the amount of carbon dioxide going out is 4% in comparison to 0.003%. Now, you don't know that, but it happens every time you breathe. And that blood is circulated around your body, and you might not be happy with your body. Your body might have aches and pains. It may be a little heavier than you'd like it, or something else. But you're a walking miracle for which we can be thankful for. The nutrients and oxygen supporting cells that form tissues, that form organs, that form organ systems, that form an organism. And it's all working together to be you. Much to be thankful for. Well, Jesus gives us an example of thanksgiving as well. In Matthew chapter 26, verse 25, Jesus is having a discussion with Judas about betrayal. Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, "Surely you don't mean me, Rabbi." And Jesus answers, "You have said so." If you go to the next verse, the next two verses, Jesus is blessing and breaking in this Jewish feast, Passover feast. He's breaking and blessing and thanking God. You know what? Betrayal and thanksgiving don't usually hang around together. They're not usually found this close to each other. Peter is going to deny him. Judas is going to betray him. And despite all of this awful stuff ahead of Jesus, he is filled with thanksgiving. So the admonition today is this. Let's determine that we're going to be part of the 10% who are thankful people, who live positive lives, who are optimistic, who are grateful, and who have giving hearts. It is true that only you can extinguish joy out of your life. It's a choice. Only you can decide to be grateful. It's a choice. And today, we're thankful for mothers. And that's a good thing, to have a day to be thankful for mothers. But really, we should be thankful all of the time. You know, not just like, "Oh, well, I'll wait until Mother's Day to be thankful." That we need to be thankful people as a part of who we are, part of our DNA, our spiritual DNA. Thankfulness is an ongoing attitude, but not merely confined to one day. Another thing that is very obvious to anybody who has been a parent, that parenting is not easy. You know, I remember before we had children, Rhonda did a lot of reading about parenting and stuff, and we would have lots of discussions about it. You know what? We were experts about it until we had Chad. And you were experts before you had children too. And once you have a child, now all of a sudden it's way different. And you know what? I think of my parents, I think of them in positive terms. But I think also, you know, they made some mistakes. Because I've been a parent, because I made mistakes, I can be more gracious with my parents because they went through the same thing that I went through. But surely, for those people in our lives who have been meaningful and loving and caring for us, who brought us into this world, and who nurtured us along the best that they could, surely we can find lots of things to be massively grateful for. So Joseph and Jesus give us two great examples of thanksgiving and gratitude. Two things that we need to be committed to have in our lives and in our words and in our behavior.
Thanks for listening to this week's sermon. The Beamsville Church of Christ meets Sunday mornings at 4900 John Street, Beamsville, Ontario. We have classes for all ages at 9:30, and the worship service begins at 10:30. You can subscribe to podcasts through Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music Store, or your favorite podcast app. Just search for Beamsville. All our past sermons and more information about our congregation are available at beamsvillechurchofchrist.ca.